After leaving his incel cave after many, many long decades of prayer, Zarathustra walked down his mountain into his nearby village, and he saw everybody congregated around waiting to be entertained by a tightrope walker. So he took the chance to tell these people something. Dear people, let me teach you about the Ubermensch. Man is something that shall be overcome, and I am here to ask you, what have you done to overcome him? All creatures have created something beyond themselves. Do you really want to be the ebb of this great flow? What is an ape to man but a laughingstock? That is what man will be to the Ubermensch. You see, the Ubermensch is the meaning of the earth. No, let your will say, the Ubermensch shall be the meaning of the earth. Oh, my brothers, I urge you, remain faithful to the earth. Do not believe those who speak to you of false otherworldly hopes. They are sour witches, mixing toxic poisons whether they know it or not. They are despisers of life, decaying and poison themselves, and the earth is wary of them. So let them go. You see, once upon a time, to sin against God was the greatest sin, but God died, and these sinners died with him. Now the most dreadful thing is to sin against the earth. To honor the intestines of an unknown promise more than the purpose of the earth. Let me ask you, what is the greatest experience that you can have? Well, I can answer. It is the hour of your greatest contempt. The hour when your happiness arouses your disgust. What does my happiness matter? What does my reason matter? What does my virtue matter? My justice. It has not made me fiery and passionate and furious with ambition. Yet these preachers of equality who call themselves the just, the reasonable, the happy, the virtuous, they are full of fire and ambition. What does this mean? What do they have that we do not? Have you ever roared like them? Have you ever cried like me? If only you wailed like this when you were on your knees crying up to heaven. I see you for what you are. You wail so you can convince yourself that you believe in something. But let me ask you, when you wail to the world above, where is the lightning that licks you with its tongue? Where is the frenzy entrances you? I teach you the Ubermensch. He is that lightning. He is that frenzy. I don't know, do you remember from school where they used to give you the little cups full of soil and you drop a seed in upside down and then the seed would reach up towards the air and the light, despite the fact you put it in upside down. And of course, you'd cut it in half and discovered that the seed opened up and went down and jolted itself back up, and the stem came back up out the correct way anyway, showing the willstumax, the will to power of the seed is immense and stronger than you can ever imagine. Now, the most important thing you have to understand about a stem, about a plant, is that the plant, the entire purpose of the plant, in a sense, is the flower, is the blossom. The way, the reason that the plant lives, the reason that the plant exists, is so that it can spread on the legacy. It can send its juice, its DNA, its message onto the next generation of plants. And so it gets dropped into the soil as a little piece of bio juice, and then it explodes, it opens up, it grows, it begins to fulfill its programming. And its programming has sent it towards a blossom. That's the end goal of it. That's when it's reached its apotheosis. That's the prime of its life. That's its pinnacle health. That's when it's individuated fully. That's when it flowers. And then it opens up those petals, allows the bees to come and pollinate it, and then it creates seeds itself and is considered a success. And it can die in peace knowing that it has done its part. And so coded within the seed is this yearning, this will, this desire to evolve, to grow, to flower, to reach up to these heights. Now, Jung, of course, noticed this too. Jung, of course, noticed that inside of people, the individuation process often was symbolically presented by dreams as a tree. And it makes perfect sense that we as humans, we go through the same pattern as a plant. We are seeded, and then we are born, and then we struggle by being upside down and bladdering around and not making any sense to ourselves. And we fight all the way until we reach adulthood, and then we flower, we blossom into our most beautiful health, and then we find our loving partner, we establish status in society, and we make our money and buy our house, and then we create kids. And then we step back and fade out of the process a little bit and become, we age, and then we slowly get prepared to leave the stage. But right there in the middle, when our flower was at its peak, our blossom was at its peak, that was the peak of our programming. That was the apotheosis, as you'd say. And apotheosis means the becoming of God, the pinnacle, the high point. And it seems trivial enough today because it sort of seems like everybody has the opportunity to have kids. But obviously back in the day, the vast majority of men, for example, would die without kids. And so you can understand that our emotions, our animating feelings are coded for that experience of the jungle where it's going to be a struggle, and the apotheosis, the ability to spread your wild oats, as they say, is felt in our bodies as a great yearning victory, a great desire, a great love, a driving factor in how we find meaning in our lives. We are designed to want to procreate. That is a core drive. It is the libido's drive par excellence, as Freud noticed. The fundamental energy that is animating us is geared towards using us like a vessel for life's secret agenda. Our hopes and our romance and our pain, all of that stuff is us getting pulled by the various instincts that populate us. Both man and women we're driven by forces bigger than us. We're merely fodder in the war of life to overcome entropy and time trying to kill us all the time. And of course, this is an obvious thing. But what does it mean when it comes to the intellect and the mind? There is a level to that as well. And this is an important thing to think about in regards to Jung. Jung discusses this quite a lot, the idea of the intellectual individuation, the psychic individuation. So of course, achieving the ticking off the boxes of procreating is an important thing for people. But the spiritual, the existential, the psychological individuation, blossoming, flowering, is a difficult question because our minds follow a similar growth pattern. Our minds are not disconnected from the instincts at all, but they must on some level then be tied to similar enough patterns. Jung would call this individuation. Jung would call this idea of reaching the fullest blossom, reaching it where your personality has reached close to wholeness, where you've achieved something of opening up your petals and become who you are, as they say. And this is all a very, very, very interesting and important idea. Jung would suggest that this is going to happen naturally and you don't really need to do anything. He says you can encourage it on by engaging in dream reading or religious practices that encourage the contents to come out. And usually the flowering is a point where you integrate your understanding of yourself, your emotions, your understanding of your thoughts and your feelings, your understanding of your body and your mind, what that piece of meat you're carrying around is, and then finally your understanding of the collective world outside and you, and seeing how they're all connected and sort of finding your place. And it's a very, very interesting idea and powerful idea. Now, what you could say about the Übermensch, that concept by naughty, nasty, screechy Nietzsche, what you could say about the Übermensch is that it was his blossoming. Zarathustra, it seems, was one of the premier experiences of his life. It was a moment that he looked back to when he was writing his later books as the great summit So that's a very important idea, because of course the flower, after it blossoms in the summertime, it may take a couple of months before it dies off, and it could look back to the summer as that great moment where it achieved what it needed to achieve. It's all downhill from there. It's easy riding from there. Now that's something very, very interesting to think about. That's an interesting feeling. When you reach the top of the mountain and you're walking downhill, you feel great, first of all, but there's a different energy at that point. You're past the peak. You're looking back on an old time, on a summit. And so Nietzsche, in some sense, through Zarathustra, had his flash of insight. He believes that he saw in that experience the future, the way, the path. He believes that he was gifted something. What happened with Zarathustra, the main book that talks about the Übermensch, what happened is he wrote that in 10 days per book. So he sat down and he blasted out the complete form in 10 days. Now, that's something else. And Jung talked about that quite a lot, as like him almost channeling his wise old man, his image of the self. And it's important to keep that stuff in mind. Like, that's a very, very, very interesting idea of like he's channeling out this peak experience, this apotheosis, this top moment of his life, something that he'd never top. Like, he doesn't have anything that stands quite as with as much mystique as Zarathustra. And that happened, in a sort of trance-like state. And, of course, the way Nietzsche describes it in Ecce Homo is that it was easy. So it kind of always wrecks everybody's head. It's like Nietzsche's like, yeah, none of my great works were hard. It was easy. They just came out of me like that, like instinct. And that's always my signal of knowing something is good. It's simple, it's fast, it's instinctive, it's easy, and it's excellent. And so maybe you have a little bit of a context to understand the energy going into this idea, because the Übermensch itself forms as the blossoming of Zarathustra's thought, and thus, as a consequence, Nietzsche's thought. He doesn't talk about it extensively in any other book bar Zarathustra. He leaves it there. And so there's something very special about this. But of course, the idea that you remember from Nasty Nietzsche is the Übermensch. That's the idea that sticks out to you. That's the idea he's known for. That's his big notion. And that's quite strange, isn't it? Now, the key foundation stone towards understanding what this alleged Übermensch is all about comes down to understanding what Nietzsche is all about. And of course, Nietzsche is the most misunderstood of all the philosophers I find. Not that most of the rest of them are even read. And the reason why that is because of the energy that people assume exists inside of him. Nietzsche is proposing a very, very naturalistic view of the world. And that naturalistic view of the world is basically discussing the obvious reality that we have to accept the laws of nature, that is the laws of the jungle, as valid in a way that we can't rationalize outside of it. Our civilization, where we get to create these safe space where everybody can hug and talk about how we're all nice to each other, is fine, is an okay place. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's not reality, you know? It's not the things that drive life. Civilizations often exist after grand wars where another civilization has been raped, murdered, and robbed by the founding civilization. If you look at all the founding myths, you see what's going on right now. All the founding myths are getting exposed. Poor America tells itself that it's all about equality and virtue and togetherness, but America was founded on violence, and that's not a condemnation of America. Sadly, everything is founded on violence, even communism. As much as they will say they're trying to, you know, take over these violent established aristocracies and establish a utopia, well, of course, in order for them to do that, unfortunately, they have to murder all the aristocracies. And what we see is that there's this endless cycle of violence in nature. Even the glorious civilizations of equality and liberty and fraternity, they are all founded on this. French Revolution is the same. This is the undercurrent, the substratum that drives everything. And Nietzsche is always trying to point you back to that and say, like, please don't think that denying that exists counts as philosophy, morality, virtue, or righteousness. It's just wishful thinking and delusion. And that's not right. And that's not good. the people who were in Russia and said that, oh, everything's just going to work out if we're just nice enough, ended up allowing their country to get taken over by a radical Bolshevik movement. And that's not virtue. That's exactly betraying the idea of evil thrives when good men do nothing, you know? And this is something you have to think about. It's a harsh world out there. And of course, this reality is so heavy, is so dark, and it's such a difficult thing to digest because it's so counterintuitive to our civilized beliefs that a lot of people really struggle with digesting them. And so when Nietzsche presents these ideas, they project onto him the shadow, the idea that he is this dark, mean man saying there's nothing but violence and he's possessed by all these bad forces and bad energies and he's a monster trying to convince you that being nasty is good and you should hurt people because that's how you feel power and that's how you feel good. He comes across like Voldemort or Saruman in the way that he's trying to intoxicate you like the devil. And of course, this is what I always come across with nasty Nietzsche. I find it so difficult when I'm talking to people about him because you'll get this coming up constantly. It's like he triggers people and they'll be like, yeah, well, he's just a nasty incel. A nasty incel who lived in his hole and wrote about how he wanted to be powerful because he was weak. And it's like, all right, fair enough. And that's fine, and that's what people see, and like it's no big deal. It's all right. People don't have to understand Nietzsche. It's fine. But I'm here to tell you what he actually is all about, and I'm here to point you towards what the actual energy he's presenting as his blossoming thesis is. And that energy is not a heavy, dark energy, but he wants you to get, you know, he wants you to get violent and punch people in the belly for being slaves, for being lower than him. That's not the energy he's founding his entire thesis, his entire belief on. What I find with Nietzsche is that when you dig through all those layers, when you actually like learn to embrace the realities that he's presenting to you, such as these horrific realities of violence and whatnot, you start to see him proposing something glorious. Because, of course, out of the chaos of nature comes the beauty of the lion, the beauty and ingeniousness of the hummingbird or the ant, the amazing tragedy, which is humanity, which is a conscious being struck by existential issues and inhibitions of forethought that is able to overcome reality and grow something beautiful like civilizations and whatnot. There's an immense amount of suffering and tragedy and violence in the world. It is true. But out of that mix, certain people and certain animals and certain realities have constantly showed up that could only be described as majestic and beautiful. The great achievement of the Renaissance, the great achievement of Rome, there was a lot of violence around that, but out of that came something glorious that we look back today that actually justifies to us, that says to us, this is why all this tragedy was worthwhile. This is why all these mistakes were worthwhile. And this is not a condoning of like going radically like, all right, we've just all got to get violent. It's actually about suggesting to you that the thing you should be focusing on is the point, is the goal, is the solution. You know, it shouldn't be about, oh, cause violence for violence sake. But it's like when bad things happen, like bad things are going to happen. You're not going to be able to get rid of pain. You're not going to be able to sedate everybody and you know, make everybody feel good feelings all the time. And that's never going to happen. You're never going to save people with hugs. You're never going to save people with sloppy, soothsaying words like, we're all in this together, we're all going to make it, let's tickle each other and kiss each other and hug in a little hovel while violence goes on all around us. We'll just hug hard enough and then the violence will go away. You're never going to save people that way. Instead, the whole thing that you need to do, the whole challenge for you, is that you need to figure out how to evoke a different feeling inside people and inside yourself. Now, this is very, very strange for the vast majority of people, because the way that we conduct our religion, and I'm not talking about Christianity, I'm talking about the implicit religion of our days, basically the thesis, the philosophical ideas about what are good emotions. You don't get to escape this. Don't get to think you're an atheist. There's no ideological way to get free from that. Your emotions are where the battle is waged, where the decision is made. And what you think about what is the right feelings versus the wrong feelings dictates everything. You can have someone who has this belief about their feelings where everybody needs to be hugged, and you can plug them into Christianity or paganism or atheism, and they'll come to very similar conclusions. Apathy, tolerance, turning the other cheek. Then you can find someone who has this other perspective, this energized perspective, and give them the same religion, and they won't see Christ as the turn the other cheek guy. They'll see Christ as he came with a fucking sword to fuck shit up and lay down the law and create justice and righteousness. They'll see God as the Lord of law and order and beauty and established power and majesty and whatnot. And their emotions will change. And this is because what is fundamental is inside of us. It is not an abstract, left-brained, pandering, ideological thing where you're going to figure out all the riddles. It is an emotional challenge. It is found and discovered and overcome and won in you. And so the big question for you and I is, what the hell is this choice? What is these other emotions? And of course, this is the problem, is that these other emotions are difficult to grasp, difficult to understand. Why? Because they're so fleeting, because they happen so rarely. It's so rare that you're filled full of fire to your fingertips and you're standing looking out across your life and saying, I want to take it all on. I believe that I can do anything. I believe that life is a good challenge, a good war. I believe that no matter how much suffering you send my way, I'll be able to digest it and spit it back out. I believe that I am capable of dealing with anything. I have the power. I have the power to transform. I can do it. I feel it. I feel vivified. I feel majestic. Now, that is not the typical experience for most people's lives. Most people's lives are led by an undercurrent of fallen feelings, of tragedy, of downward feelings, of heaviness, of sadness, of suffering. And they want love, they want acceptance, they want validation, they want someone to make the pain and go away. Hence the other leading emotion. And that's okay. I get it that people are in pain, and Nietzsche got it too. And he didn't like that. He didn't think, oh, ha, 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 fuck them. He did actually see it as a tragedy, but he was a cynical realist. Is that when you're in pain, it's not like someone validating your pain is going to make it go away. Sometimes you need not love, but tough love. You need to be told to toughen up. You need to be told not that I love you and your pain is all this and all that and hugs will make it go away. You need to be told you can overcome your pain. And that belief is rare, and that belief in a person is rare, and a person who runs with this belief for long enough to become strong and capable in the real world is even rarer. And a civilization that centers its entire feeling on that energy and overcomes the tragedy of reality to create something like English Empire, Rome, the German Empire, Russia, China, Japan, to create something like majestic like that, that is extremely, extremely rare. Extremely, extremely difficult. But that doesn't devalue it. That actually promotes its value. We know this matters because everybody looks to these peak moments in society where these great things were achieved with reverence, even thousands of years after they existed. People look to Rome with awe. Rome, the architecture still is littered everywhere. The languages, the words that we use is completely populated by Rome, by Latin. We are completely shaped by that peak experience. The Renaissance is something that makes the Italians millions and millions and millions of dollars per year because there's so much vibrancy and beauty and what was pulled off. Even though it's long gone, Italy is not what it used to be anymore. Even though that peak is gone, we still look back to that because it's an incredible testament to what was pulled off. It was such a rare feat. And Nietzsche, you can understand as sort of an architect. In fact, you could understand him as a man with a butterfly net trying to run around and capture this feeling. You could see underneath Rome, underneath the Renaissance, underneath the European 19th century, you can see in that the blossoming of 1,000 different forces from a people, from their pains, from their suffering, their religion, their finances, all of that stuff goes together, flows all in one and flowers in these peak civilizational experiences. All this art shows up that is very empowering and vivifying and life-giving. And then, of course, they die and they fade. But what stays is that memory of what that was. It stays with us, the skeleton, if you will, the shapes, the statues, like the way we look at ancient Greece. And it's unforgettable. When that blossomed, it was so powerful and majestic that we all stand in awe in comparison to it. We all feel like little seedlings, maybe even lower plants, like little weeds compared to it, because there was something so incredible pulled off. And Nietzsche is trying to capture that feeling and understand what that feeling is and show it to people and hold it to people. Hold it to people as a light in the darkness. Hold it to people as a treasure and say to it, this has happened before and it can happen again. And if we were to talk about what is right or wrong, shouldn't we be saying, well, this is right. This is the place where we should place our bets. This is where the hammer should fall. And why does he propose this? Well, it actually does come down to that problem of pain. Every single struggle, every single failure, every single heartbreak, every single war, every single ounce of blood that a young man spilt, every single death that a woman went through through childbirth of the Italian people, all needed to have a point. Like, why do we suffer? Why do we struggle? Why do these poor people go through the arduous dearth of crappy jobs or slave labor or working for the bankers and all this? Like, what's the point? What's the consequence? What's the reason for this? And it's the same challenge that the flower tries to understand. Why am I struggling when this fucking weird Irish man has put me upside down in my cup? Why am I struggling to reach up to the sun when it has that urge? It's like, why is this happening? And of course, the cells within the flower will say to it, it's like, one day we will blossom and it will be so beautiful. And we'll attract all the honeybees from all around the world. And for that moment, we will be gods. We will stand eternal. And so inside the minds of all the cells within the flower, they see this archetype, this floating conception of the blossoming petaled sunflower, the final completion. They feel it. Maybe they don't even know it. Maybe they can't even see it consciously. They don't even know the plan, but something in them has this urge towards this thing. And this is life operating in her extremely noble and healthy way. And it's leading us on to something incredible, something beyond ourselves, something that would make everything worthwhile. Now, what you need to understand about humanity and the Renaissance and the Italian artists is that Michelangelo was the vessel for the Italian people to begin this flowering. He was the little cell that started to bend open the petals. He was the craftsman, the specialist, you know. Most of their cells were like, be a leaf, be a photosynthesizing leaf, be a green yolk, make more, be more green. They're all green, they're all the same all the way up until this final part where they're ready, where it's now time that they make something unique and special. There's not many of them. There's only a couple, but these guys, these new cells, these crazy bastards, they're all different than the green stems. They're different from everything that's come before. And their job is to make things that are colourful, that smell nice, that look good. And this is it. This is the blossoming moment. This is the moment where Michelangelo shows up in the flower and he lifts it, he opens it all out, and he does it with style and grace. This is the part where you spend all your resources in going wild, going crazy. Make it look good. Go big, bad, and bombastic. And the cells don't bitch at Michelangelo like rats. They rejoice along with him. They celebrate through you, Michelangelo. We are winning. You are the representative. You are the completion of our struggle. And you aren't doing it in some type of egotistical way. You're a vessel for this great, great process. You are the vessel of the spirit of the flower to achieve what it needs to achieve. You are the vessel of God to represent our spirit. So let us revisit the challenge of life. Life's poor fickle little drama and discuss the important role of the hype man, of what the flower is. Because, you know, the majority of rock concerts or rap concerts or public speaking events constitute someone on stage blossoming and flowering and dancing and putting on a show. And the vast majority of people being in the crowd, funding the event, you know, putting it all together, getting everything in order. And so there's a lack of an equality here. What you've got is you've got one person doing one role that brings good energy out of the people in the crowd. And this is because they are different, because fundamentally the person on stage is doing something the people in the crowd cannot do. This is the nature of sports. It's the nature of everything. Okay, and why is this valuable? Like, when you're sitting there, I'm sure you've heard Jordan Peterson talk about this, when the ballet, the ice skater comes out and does these ridiculous like flips and spins and everybody's on the edge of their seats watching it. Why are they on the edge of their seats? Well, of course, it's because they're seeing this actor, this superhuman performer reaching the absolute edge of their ability. It's like watching life at its peak in that moment, and it evokes out of you something incredible, something profound, something difficult to understand, but something vastly important, probably one of the most important things out of humanity. It is the feeling you get when watching a hero overcome the energy of all odds. And why is this valuable? It's not like the people are really getting anything out of it. They're not getting paid. They're actually losing money to watch this. They're not going through the experience themselves. And even the sports star or the performer, it's not like they're really getting that much. Maybe social status, which of course is a valuable thing, I guess, in the end of things. But you think about it, it's sort of a nihilistic, pointless activity. What you're just sort of simulating the hunt when you're playing American football or any type of team sports of some sort. But of course, we run these simulations, and seeing people on the exceptional edge is like a great motivator. Well, why is this? How does this relate to the artist reaching the pinnacle of their ability? Michelangelo flowering out of the Italian people and putting together the great statue of David. Like, why does that matter? It's not like it achieves anything. It's like making a rock look more interesting. And it's like, yeah, dude, well, you know, the world's going to end anyway. Entropy is going to slowly chew up the world anyway. It's not like you should really bother. In fact, it's not really going to stop anyone from feeling bad and ending suffering. It's kind of a pointless activity when you think about it. And of course, the nihilistic left brain believes this, but we want to actually latch into that belief, that denial of that energy, and show how that is the key towards understanding the great drama, which is life. Because I've said this before, I'll say it again. Life is fucked. Life is in an awful situation where it's flung into the matrix, the demiurge's matrix, that David Icke is the only one who has woken up to the nature of this reality. It's been flung into the demiurge's matrix 13 billion years ago, and all the scientists are like figuring it out, being like, there's a big bang. And that's when the will to life was dropped in. Now, what was that? It was almost like this big explosion of energy, so raw and so fundamental that it wasn't even necessarily life as we understand it yet. It was just sheer, unadulterated energy. And that energy itself is the universe coming into being all those eons ago. And it's been struggling. It's been stuck in this Minecraft, you know. It was, as I've said before in that last video about Jordan Peterson, it was Minecraft was dead and still, and God plugged it in, and that electricity that went in to animate Minecraft, that's literal reality. That's literal life. That's literal movement. And this has been injected into Minecraft, and now there's a sort of clock running where eventually all that energy is going to peter out and die. And so this energy has an awful problem where there's almost like this thing, this spirit, this being of death called entropy floating through Minecraft, trying to slowly crush out all the animation, trying to slowly bring it back to stillness again and perfection in its head. And this is what's been going on. Life has been fighting against this. The animating energy of life has been fighting against this for eons and eons and eons. And it started off as the stars bullying the blackness out of the sky with their resonant glowing power. And now, And you can even think of it this way, like think about what was going on there. There was all this gravity pulling together all these rocks that weren't that exceptional themselves, or this matter that was kind of like the crowd. But then over time, a critical mass was hit and that energy all consolidated and exploded into a burning, resonant, blossoming flame that stood and created heat and energy and outward energy that now shines and creates light. And all the other balls of rock in the universe floating around look over across the horizon. They'd be like, look at that boy out there. Jesus, Lord, look at him. He's after fucking going on fire, lads. That's mad. And then they all get hyped and then they all try to do it as well. And that's what took us up from the level of total darkness into the level of, well, light bulbs being all over the sky that are still there. And then, of course, Neil deGrasse Tyson, his spirit began and he said, soon, one day, these will all be people. We are all stardust fundamentally. So all the gold and the chemicals and all that stuff that was made in the stars then arrived on Earth somehow. Not with any alien help, of course. That's a ridiculous idea. Not with some type of comet carrying the spores of an overlord magic mushroom to seed the Earth. No, not that at all. Instead, life evolved naturally out of the goop of chemicals that was pooling on Earth. And it formed into the basic animals, basic bacteria, all that type of stuff. And then life moved to another level. So again, you had all this dead matter that was floating around, being like a kind of a loser, but hugging together, getting all together in a bit of a crew. And then suddenly all these chemicals just go whoop, and DNA gets made. And we don't need to talk about this. It's not like it's weird at all. And it all just kind of comes together for no reason and forms together and becomes the first being. And then all the other big blobs of chemicals that are doing nothing are over looking at it being like, whoa, that's class. That's fucking awesome, man. Let's try that. And so they all goop. They all get hyped as these chemicals blossom into the first animated living beings. And Minecraft goes up a level. And then, of course, it keeps going. It keeps going. It keeps going. It keeps going. And soon we have like these weird little fish climbing out of the water into the land. And again, this fish, he kind of like struggles out. This is your great granddaddy. And he's like, yo, bro, let's go and go up into that sand beach. Let's get a tan up there. And then all the other fish are like, what? Look, that's crazy. Let's go follow that dude. Let's go lay some eggs up there as well. And then eventually that starts the next movement. And then the next movement is, of course, the mammals or the reptiles, the mammals, the great apes, and finally humanity. And so what leads life forward is inspiration. What leads life forward is this energy of, oh my God, he did it. Oh my God, he did it. And of course, this pattern, this eternal, this most sacred pattern is led by heroes taking the leap, taking the courageous next step, you know, the blossoming characters leading us on. And in some sense, you've got to have some compassion for life because life's a tough thing. Like if you're just this big ball of helium in the deadness of space, that'd be kind of shit, man. There'd be nothing going on. And you're like, man, I should just eradicate myself and return to the abyss. But then out of nowhere, off in the distance, this one flickering energy explodes and inspires you again. And you think about the challenge, you know, the entropy that floats through all of reality, all of Minecraft trying to stamp out all the parties. Like all these bits of helium conglomerate together to have a bit of a boyo party. And then entropy comes in and makes them all hate each other and dissipate. And that destroys the possibility of that helium becoming a star. And so there's this sort of tragic thing where it's very hard to get stuff going. And the populace of Minecraft often get demoralized. You know, they get beaten down by entropy and entropy stands there laughing, being like, I ruined another party, man. Class. And life goes through this as well. The chemicals went through the same thing. The original fish getting eaten by all the predators. There was probably some weird fish that ate eggs and all the other fish were losing their babies to this weird egg-eating fish. And then they're all demoralized, like, we should just kill ourselves. There's no way out of this. We're trapped. And this one fish says, let's lay eggs on the beach. And that's where it starts, you know. He finds a solution, an incomprehensible solution, literally like taking them into a different cosmos, you know, like the dry land was as understandable, comprehensible to the fish as the internet is to someone from the 18th century, you know. but it's where everything is going. And then the same thing with humanity. Like, think of that scene in 2001, A Space Odyssey, where the monkey first picks up the stick and makes a weapon. This great innovation of war, of course, of violence, but it is a step forward in a sense. The monkey understands how to use the tool. And this is this constant reiteration and blossoming and taking things up a higher level. This is what life is. It's a constant, incomprehensibly intense ascendancy. And that's in counteraction to this constant, ever-looming spirit of death and entropy and decay. Everything's getting pulled apart. You were born and you're like a heartbeat. That's what your 70 to 80 years on this life is. It's a heartbeat that starts as this rising, peaks from 20, 30 to 40, and then the heartbeat begins to wane after that and entropy takes its toll. And just for those 30 years where you're ascending, it feels incredible. You're indomitable and you've got so much life in you, and then eventually your ion ends. And that's an incredibly difficult thing, because everybody's suffering from the entropy sucking the ion out of them, the life out of them, the era out of them. Their time in the sun is challenged, and it's a very, 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 very difficult problem. But the greatest thing I guess you can do for life is to remind it that this potential, this blossoming, this inspiration, this overcoming is possible. Because you think about what's the hardest thing for life itself is spiritual. It's a demoralization thing. It's the lack of hope. It's the lack of belief. And it's a very, very sad thing. And everybody thinks, oh my God, all right, we're not going to make it. The inspiration is over. We're all going to, there's no way out of this. We're stuck in the water, or, you know, we can't fight this evil tribe. And then someone innovates or makes a weapon of some sort, or they climb on land. It's a huge inspiration and blossoming. And that energy of inspiration is literally the gold dust that keeps life moving forward. Now, of course, people's response to the tragedy of life, to the demonic power of entropy, is to default towards cuddling together and saying, we're in this together. And that's not like, this is not a dismissal of that value. There's something to love, of course, and compassion and community, certainly. But it's not the solution. The hero is not the one who binds with the herd, who binds with the huddles together in the corner in fear and holding each other saying, we've got this. The hero is the one who actually steps out of that and goes in to do something insane, which actually helps the herd in the long run, which advances the herd. And this is why they're almost always separate from the herd, Uber from the herd, as they say. And this is where you start to really get a grip of what all this stuff means. Michelangelo crafting King David was almost like a hype track, a reminder to the Italian people, a reminder to the herd what they are. They are life, a way for them to experience their power, a way to spiritually motivate themselves, to moralize themselves, to remind them that entropy is a fucking loser in the end, and he always loses, and we always win. Life always wins, always. We wouldn't be here if it didn't. You understand that life has a 100% win rate. You might not have it, your individual self might not have it, but life, using you as a vessel, it crushes entropy like a bitch all the time. Entropy is some type of loser trying to ruin the party, and he keeps failing. The parties just get bigger and more interesting and more badass. And so this is a key thing to understand, the inspiring energy of the hero, of the great artist, of the great creator, of the great winner. Think of the first man to learn how to throw a spear and kill a bison or kill a mammoth. Imagine the vivid energy that these early men would have felt. Imagine the first person to make an army like the 300 Spartans in the phalanx and conquer an army 10 times its size. Imagine that feeling. To be like, oh my God, we can do anything. And think about what that does to your emotions. The thing that crushes you is the hopelessness of, I am trapped as I am and I am destined to suffer as entropy slowly tightens its grip on me. And then this energy here, this heroic energy, tells you, you as life have 100% win rate of overcoming this. And here's proof, and you can watch me. And now you start to see the value in this energy that Nietzsche's promoting, the energy of the inspired, of the vivified, of the overcoming being, of the believer, of the hopeful, of the one willing to challenge entropy and destiny. You'll notice that among the herd, they have all these rules. They say, oh, well, you can't do that because reasons. These are, of course, the people huddling in the corner being like, well, you can't go onto the beach because you'll die, because it's morally wrong to go on the beach. That's the realm of the gods or something like that. What we're going to do is we're going to huddle in together in love and hope that the egg-eating fish doesn't come get us. Now, consider how much of a chain that is around the ankles of the hero who does need to break away from the herd and break the rules. Oh, Michelangelo, you can't paint naked David. He's, you know, that's unbiblical or something like that. It's like, well, maybe we got to drop this guy and allow the energy to lead here, because the energy is what matters. I'll give you an example for the Irish. The Irish have a bit of an inferiority complex, as I'm sure you might understand. We see ourselves as 1,000 years a slave, and we have this chip on our shoulder towards the Brits. And that's sort of funny. I love playing around with that, but actually it has deeply scarred the mind of the Irish. And it's not the English's fault. It's our inability to understand, to feel ourselves as anything more than slaves. So we have this sort of sarcastic nature to ourselves. Now, on top of that, there's this problem where we don't see ourselves as winners. So when the Irish do something, we don't achieve it. You know, we do it for the banter, the crack. You know, we're not serious and professional. Soccer is a great way to experience this. When the Irish went to the World Cup in 2002 or 3 or something like that, I think it was, our greatest player left because he felt that the Irish were coming over for the party. You know, they'd go over, they train and they drink. They weren't in it to win. And this guy, Roy Keane, he was furious at the Irish because it was like, why, like, you're not serious. You're not actually intent on making this happen. Like, we're not trying to succeed here. And that was an infuriating experience for Roy, because he wanted to go in there with the intention to win. We were just being the kind of token Irish guys to float along. You will know us from soccer as the guys who show up and lose 3-0 and get really drunk and are louder and cheering and doing chants. You know, it's like we're just happy to be there. And there's something kind of charming about that. We're making the party where it is. But there is something kind of like sad about that. We're not serious. We're not actually game players. We're not actually winners, you know. And this, we carry this chip with us a lot. There's this attitude that floats around Ireland, this crab in the bucket attitude that we're never going to be a winner. And any guy or hero who steps out, like any crab that begins to reach out of the bucket, all the other crabs in Ireland, the crabby Irish, we grab him by the leg and pull him back down and be like, remember, you're one of us. You're not going anywhere, bro. We don't win and you're one of us. None of us win. And it's an intense attitude. And it's not as malicious as that sounds. It's actually just a lack of belief. It's almost like we lack the ability to believe that entropy won't beat us. Now, Conor McGregor showed up in the scene, and the reason why he took off so much here, obviously around the world as well, is because he was completely immune to that attitude. He was completely the antithesis of that attitude. He had the heroic spirit par excellence. As much as you may dislike him, he was literally the embodiment of this energy, and I'll tell you why. We have this sort of behavior in Ireland where we take part in the game, and we get drunk and we lose, but we're there for the crack. But of course, what was Conor's famous phrase where he says, I'm not a token Irish guy. I'm not here to show up and be like, hey, the drunk Irish guy is here. He said, I am not here to take part. We are not here to take part. We are here to take over. That's the assertion of absolute authority, the mentality of a winner. He goes to the huddles of fish on the sea bank and says, guys, we're not here to kind of like, you know, just give our eggs and hope that the big beast goes away, to sacrifice our eggs to the big demonic monster out there. He's like Hercules who says, I'm going to kill the monster. Or Daedalus who says, I'm going to find a way to escape the monster. And he fundamentally has to go against the mindset of the crowd, the entropic mindset of the crowd. The mindset of the crowd that lives in fear of entropy's power. And so this is what he does. And it starts there, but it gets crazier with Connor. Connor was an incredible, credible person, especially in this era, because he worked his way up and he had this new attitude of, I'm here to win. I'm in it to win. And all the Irish are like, what? One of us can win. And I remember the feeling. I remember like when he was feeling that, I'd feel electric listening to him. Because it was like a validation of a feeling I would only ever find in Nietzsche, you know? That it's like, it's okay. You can win and it's okay to win and your possibilities are limitless. And I really, really like felt that. I felt that so deeply, such a powerful emotion. And he was embodying that for me. He was gifting that to me. That's how valuable this man is. He lifted an entire generation. My entire generation got into fighting and positive thinking because of this dude. Like you can't measure how much that guy helped people's mental health. You know, like you couldn't, a million psychotherapists couldn't do the job that he did, because a million psychotherapists aren't as strong and courageous and ballsy as he was. Because all you need is to see one person figuring out a way, and then everybody can understand. Life needs to be proven. You know, it's like the idea with the mile. Everybody thought it was impossible to run under a 4-minute mile. And then in the 60s, some guy did it. And then the next year, like 18 other people did it, you know, because the mental barrier had been broken. And you think about the nature of our quote unquote mental illnesses and our pain. You think about the nature of that, and that's all down to this set of prisons, this set of limits we place in our mind. And we often try to get people to psychologically fix these barriers for us and tell us like, oh, which archetype is this, the way I integrate, or which Freudian neurosis is that, the way I integrate. And look, there's definitely something to that. I've spoken to schizophrenics and whatnot. It's a very, very interesting and challenging way that the mind goes iffy, we'll put it this way. But the sort of general thrust is understanding that the reason why your emotions are dampened is not because you lack love, it's because you lack inspiration. And through inspiration on the right hand and love on the left hand, you can fucking destroy most of your bad moods and dominate entropy like a little bitch. You can spank entropy with both of those if you wish. And so Connor fills me full of this energy, fills all my friends full of this energy. And we're like, wow, a winner in the UFC. That's awesome. And then he goes along and he says, I'm going to take on Jose Aldo. And Aldo is this 10-year, decade-long champion who's never been beaten. And we're all like, oh, bro, take it easy there, man. Don't get ahead of yourself. We're like, ooh. I don't know, bro. That's a bit much now. Like, you're a cool dude. You're a winner, but oof, I don't know. And he comes out and he says, do you think this is a game? Do you think this is a sort of thing where I'm going to get a token victory and then I'm going to back down back into my place? Boyos, I'm all in. I'm in this to the absolute end. I'm in this for the penultimate challenge. I'm going to the very, very top. And this is when we all get nervous, because like that burst of inspiration where it's like we're not losers is kind of comfortable. But now it's getting into the level of like, this is like, you know, the guy goes up and he figures out he can hide the eggs on the beach. And then he says, let's go into the forest. And you're like, whoa, bro, we just took one step. Let's not go this far. But this is, of course, what the energy of life is. It is Faustian. It is this desire to sail across the Atlantic, this desire to reach into space, this desire, like Jung, to dive into the depths of the mind, the desire of Nietzsche to re-understand history from its correct perspective. These immense, crazy desires that everybody like waves the finger at these people and says, no, you've gone too far now. Well, it's a very unrelenting feeling. When the sun goes nuclear, you know, it starts as all this helium gathered together, and then it gets a bit warm and everyone's like, yeah, party's on, warm. But then it explodes into a supernova. And everybody's like, whoa, bro, that's a bit much. You can't just be like blowing up into an eternal beast of indomitable light. But of course you can, and you will. And this is the energy, this is the thing, is that if you're going to be sincere to this energy, you must give it its due. And so, of course, Connor comes around and he says, I'm going to beat Aldo. And everybody's like, nah, bruh. But of course, he goes for it. And he asserts, I will. I will. And he keeps being assertive. And then what happens is incredible. He goes in and he beats Aldo in 13 seconds. And it looks easy. And I remember on that night, you know, Conor had a lot of hype. And it was sort of like, oh, is this guy just, is he delusional? Because that's what we always think of these type of people. We think they're delusional. We think, you know, the guy fighting the big evil eggfish or climbing onto the beach, we think they're delusional. Think they're out of their minds. And you don't, you ignore them in the corner. It's like, yeah, you're just talking shit though, dude. Yeah. You're going to climb on the beach. Yeah, sure. And you have this kind of anxiety when they're going for it, because you're like, there's a lot on the line here, bro. Because if you say you're going to do it and you don't do it, then yeah, you are. You're insane. You're delusional. And of course, he'd been saying, I'm going to beat Aldo. And everyone's like, bro, you can't beat Aldo. You can't just beat Aldo. But of course, he steps in. He does it like with ease. He could have fought another fight the next day if he wanted to. He didn't take any damage. Well, he did. He got a cut, but the myth stands stronger. But nonetheless, he does that. And I remember all of us sitting down on the couch at like 5 a.m. or something, because that's how you Yanks tyrannize the poor Irishman. And then we all like launched out of our chairs. We couldn't believe it. One of my friends, I remember it didn't even feel real for a second. I was sort of looking at it being like, now that doesn't make, there's been no fight. Where's the fight though? That, no, wait. So this is like a warm up or something. Where's the real fight? And then my friend just screams, he did it. Wired out of his mind in MDMA as well. But he was like, yeah, he did it. We're like, what? He did it. And we were all buzzed for weeks after that. And you see, the absolute crux of this is obviously the feeling of inspiration. Now, what is so incredible about this is that feeling of my vision, my words, my theory about the future is real. Like Conor was very famous for being called Mystic Mac. We predict these things. We believe he'll get knocked out after two rounds. And this thesis, this take, this perspective Conor had is that he was able to say something and it would come into existence thereafter is a very, very interesting thing, because it's very, very close to the way people talk about their lives. What's your dream? What's your dream? What's your dream job? What dream do you want to make real? And of course, that's what it all comes down to, is there's this little flickering idea in my head of a possibility. And then the hero is the one who's, first of all, able to dream. Because this is where the first problem comes in. You're sitting down there on the bank under the water with the herd. And they're all like, we're being tortured by the egg beast. So what we'll do is we'll give one egg and try keep five. And then you start to dream. That becomes a religion, you know. It's like you give the egg for in the ritual and don't anger the beast of the deep, okay? And this is the ritual. And you say, no, imagine if we could stop giving this beast the egg and kill the beast and eat him and then use that power to climb up on the beach. And you say this, and they have all of these mental limits in place, these religious ideas. And they first of all, they'll imprison you. To say, well, that's first of all actually evil. That's the antithesis to the religion. That's morally wrong to try save the eggs from the beast, because this is what we've been doing for generations. So first of all, you don't even think that way because you've been taught your whole life not to think that way. So that's the first prison, the first chain. It begins in your mind through the collective that gave it to you. The second chain is then when you actually start to think for yourself. So you break yourself free from that stuff intellectually, and you're like, well, maybe we could kill the thing. But of course, you don't tell anybody. You just start to think that. You overcome it. Then you start to try hint at people. Maybe we should kill the beast. And they will start to reinforce the collective dream. No, my God, no. Oh my God, are you insane? Don't ever say that again. The beast will hear us and come out of the ground and eat us. And so there's your second problem. You get massive pushback from the herd. And then maybe you do some great feats and you get a bit of reputation. And then people sort of take you serious. And then so you decide, all right, I've got the status now. And you openly say, I want to take down the beast. and they will look at you and be like, you're insane. That can't happen. So you've gone from allowing yourself the dream, challenge one, to trying to talk about your dream, challenge two, to proving that you're competent, challenge three, and now you're still in the position where they don't want to hear it. And so what makes the hero exceptional and special is that he's able to, at the resistance of the crowd, have these flickering little dreams that no one ever, first of all, allows him to believe. And then when they do allow him to believe, they laugh at him merely, don't take serious because they don't believe it's possible. And then you finally make that happen. You finally overcome all the challenges and reveal and kill the big egg beast from the deep. And then you get this incredible proof. I can do anything. We can do anything. You and I, we're all humans, we're all the same. We can do incredible things. And so you see that this blossoming is the form of the hero, and of course in the form of the artist who creates great art. It is an incredible vivifying redemption, reassertion to life itself of what it's capable of and what its purpose is. Its purpose is to follow this emotion. Its purpose is not anything else but this. The challenge of life is that it's getting murdered by entropy all the time. And your challenge is to find this emotion, because this is the emotion that has always killed entropy, always defeated entropy. It is an indomitable emotion that is always there and always inside of you, and it's one of the rarest. This is why things like great art, they're so special, because they're like something ideal and perfect that is bigger than life, that is more powerful, more purified, the whiskey of life, you know? It's more special, more unique, more delicate. And that's what inspiration is like. You only rarely feel such an emotion, such a profound feeling. You only climb the mountain for maybe 20 minutes before you have to go back down. You only reach the peak rarely. And it's a treasure that emotion exists in us at all. Considering the entropy, the sludge of imprisoning beliefs that are hammered into our brain the second we enter school, and then the begrudging chains that social signaling puts on top of us when we try to believe in ourselves, and the sheer incomprehensible force of you cannot do this that is so common and present in everything. Even in places where you find people who read Nietzsche and read all this stuff, they'll still tell you, you know, Jordan Peterson, oh, well, you can't reevaluate your values. And it's incredible. It's incredible just how much we want to remain prisoners, because we're scared of what this great emotion demands of us. And that's the secret. You see, the inspiration is a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, it says that you can. But believing that you can overcome your situation is also indicative of that you're going to have to transform into something capable of overcoming, which is to say that you can transform into something capable of overcoming your situation. Conor McGregor, the fighter, understands that when I say I'm going to beat Aldo, he's going to have to back that up with work. He's going to have to train and transform into an Uber Conor, a level up, you know. And he's comfortable. He's comfortable that, all right, if I'm going to say these words, I'm going to have to back them up, and that's going to change me. But the assertiveness underneath that is incredible. And you think about the fear inside a person. If you were going to take your words serious, the fear that evokes inside of you, you should be terrified when you use words, when you say, I'm going to make it. That's a terrifying thing, because that means you're going to have to take thousands of hours of loneliness and disrespect and low status and hunger and lack of money and all that. And that's exactly what Connor's life was like. He was a loner. He was out of cash. You know, he was stealing from people. He was broke. He couldn't go out with his friends and all that. And that's the emotions that he had to feel. And just in those moments, he's running through these little halls by himself, practicing some weird kick for the thousandth time in the middle of the night, and all he has is his dreams, is his mind, is the flickering imagination in his head. And it seems like nothing, and when you see someone like that, you don't respect it in any way. But the 10 years later, when he's manifesting all those dreams as this big, profound world attention domination of the greatest fighting championship in the world, that's when you start to pay attention. But you don't understand the gravitas required to make that happen. And this is the thing, there's fear of inspiration, there's fear of going for it, there's fear of the incredible heights, there's fear. But it's all this energetic energy, it's all this awakening energy. And from this, you can start to understand, you can start to see what something like the Übermensch is for Nietzsche. Because Nietzsche looks out across at European people. And these people set the cultural agenda for the world. America currently sets the cultural agenda for the world, widely considered a European state. And what's built into the European philosophical mind, as Nietzsche said, was the nihilism idea. And that ideal, that perspective, that the way that the Europeans as a whole were seeing the world has geared them towards thinking and idolizing and religiously lifting up the values of the huddling fish on the bank in the corner, saying that you can't. And it doesn't matter if it's Christian or if it's atheist, it's all the same energy, the same emotion, the same instinct that is the fire at root of it. And it is this feeling of togetherness, of we're going to cling to this ball of rock and hug each other and hope for the best, because there's no getting out of this. The universe, entropy is going to defeat us, Minecraft is going to get destroyed, and being inspired and aiming for the stars, that's just disrespectful towards the poor or towards all the people who have mental health problems. And what we need to do is we need to sacrifice the grandeur of going to space and all this in order to coddle the people who are in pain. And the way that we coddle them is by developing this complicated health science where we have all these chemicals and pills that will make their pain go away. And it's this incredible validation of everything Nietzsche was saying. It's terrible because Nietzsche was not saying that things would turn out well. This is why most people hated him. But of course, he was proven correct. So maybe most people should have taken him more serious. But now the expose has happened. Now you look around you and you see his prophecy come to fruition ad maximum. And there's no denying it anymore. And you must understand, again, people think he's some type of nasty, bad man trying to scare you and hurt your feelings. But he's trying to say the reason why the world has gotten so weird around you and everyone's gotten so neurotic and everyone's gotten so obsessed with this limited entropic thinking about what is possible, and they've gotten so dogmatic, despite the fact that they don't have a religion, they're still worse than the dogmatists of the 19th century. The reason why that has all happened is because of a choice inside the vast majority of us to favor one feeling as opposed to another feeling. And this is to deify the feminine feeling of community and love. And that's okay. These are good feelings. We're not saying deny that stuff. But if you go black and white and celebrate that at the expense of the masculine, assertive feeling of the heroic, virtuous, courageous dream manifester, the inspiring, bombastic, crazy hero, you lose everything. Everything is built on this. This is the foundation towards the advancements of civilization. As I said, these are like man and woman. They must be shining to their fullest potential in order for anything to happen and go anywhere. And of course, we've chosen falsely the other feeling, and we're decaying as a people, decaying spiritually. Then we slowly catch up and start to be decay in actuality. And for Nietzsche, his solution to this, like you just don't understand how smart this guy was, that he called this back in the time when everybody was like, didn't even see this as remotely near a problem. They were 120 years away from this being actually a serious, serious, serious problem. But now we're starting to get into it. He called this, and he actually called this and gave a solution to it. It's like, what? And his solution is very, very simple. And it wraps around it quite a lot with what Jung talks about, by about learning how to right-brainify your feelings. Okay, and this is kind of my spiel too, but the big problem you find with most people is that they have a dead, left-brained, nihilistic, modern materialist conception of how their emotion, what their emotions are. It's jargon. Love is good because it feels nice, because I say so, because it's therefore the best value. And it's just all confusing jibber-jabber that you like, I'm probably not even making that much sense now, because it doesn't. It's this understanding, it's this consciousness that the ancient Greeks, when they understood the word anger, they didn't think of it like bad chemical to be replaced with good chemical. They understood it as Aries, complex, vivid personality connected to 1,000 different myths that you need to learn to interpret properly. And this is not a trivial thing. Christians had this as well. This is not a trivial thing at all. This is a smart relationship to one's emotions. When you are visited by these horrible moods, you have this complex and brilliant, well-articulated together story to help you process them. This helps you be animated. What are moods? As Jung would say, the anima. What are emotions? The anima. They're energies flowing through you designed to animate you towards goals. They're the anima. They're the animating energies. And if you have good stories built up around them from your collective, you'll be able to participate in them. This is why initiations for young men were always them experiencing the gods and learning all the stories properly. And this shows them how to interpret their moods and their animating energies. And then it shows them how to reach forward into reality. And of course, when we castrate ourselves from, first of all, intellectually understanding this stuff, we fall into the jargon of like, oh, well, it's just anger, which is just chemicals, and sadness, which is just chemicals, and depression, which is just chemicals, and happiness, which is just chemicals, and love, which is just chemicals. And so all these flat set of chemicals, well, all we need to do is rearrange the chemicals to feel the good chemicals, which are nice, comfortable chemicals, which is those chemicals when it feels like we're all hugging each other. This is why everyone takes MDMA. Feels like we're all part of a little huddle in our little, clinging to our little chunk of sand, tortured by all these beasts in the outside world who are the bad, ambitious ones. And we can huddle together and hug each other. And this can be, we can lift this feeling up into a god. A Christian possessed by this feeling would see that feeling as Jesus Christ. Of course, a Chad Christian possessed by the other's instinct would see Jesus Christ as the sword bringer. The instinct is fundamental. But of course, the atheist huddled in the sand would lift this feeling up and perhaps see it as like Mother Ayahuasca or some type of, you know, integrate the feminine. This is the great era of Mother Earth or something like that. We'll find a way to spiritualize that emotion. There's a lot of goddess worship going on right now. You see it in the way we interact with each other. And it's all rooted in this decision in your heart to deal with your emotions in this way. And of course, Nietzsche proposes, like unbelievably smartly, that why don't we deify the other instinct? Again, we've done it before, we can do it again. Hercules was probably a real guy who was so perfectly embodied this energy, like Conor McGregor did, that he got turned into an archetype, turned into a myth that was full of that energy that inspired the Greek people to be like him and became a center point for their religion. Like you can imagine the Irish probably would have done that with Conor had we been in that mode of thinking, say we're in the ancient world. That's probably what Cú Chulainn was. And Nietzsche, sitting there, sees this philosophical problem and realizes that you can throw out 97% of philosophy as just jargon and chatterbraining about technical issues that don't actually matter in the end. Because if you don't have this instinct firing, it's like a car with a supercomputer but no engine. It's not going to go anywhere. And then, like, you know, a mob of people will run in and just rip its tires off and pull it apart. And so the fundamental question is on this level. And this is the intelligence, the sophistication of his simple thinking, that if you can look at this problem on this level, that's actually like probably the greatest intellectual victory of all. Because most people get stuck on a different level. And therefore they don't get anywhere. Oh, what did Nietzsche mean by God is dead? Oh, well, technically you can't recreate your own values because, you know, Jung said so. Oh, Atheism is correct because God is not just some man in the sky. It's all whistling past the graveyard. It's all matters of no consequence. It's all jibber-jabber. It's all the chattering of a group of people stuck in the sand trying to justify to themselves what they're already doing. That's all it is. And what you need to understand, what you need to focus on, is that emotion, that inspiring emotion within yourself. Because you know it exists. You feel it. Go on YouTube and watch Humans Are Incredible. Or watch Conor McGregor. Or next time a hero shows up in some sense or form, just pay attention to how you feel about it. And that emotion will come up. And it's fleeting, and then it'll sink back down and you'll be depressed again and you'll want love and acceptance and all that type of stuff. And that's fine. Again, I don't like the counter-signaling that. Like, it's a healthy feeling to have, but it's contextualized. It's man and woman, you know? And this man, this male energy of inspiration, this is everything. This is the where the hammer falls. It's the one thing we're missing the most. Sure, or it can get badly aspected and maybe turn into a tyrant, but that's really not our problem. Our problem is the opposite. We are, you know, low testosterone, lacking this energy completely. We have no ability to assert reality. We don't even have the ability to dream. That's our first problem. And so Nietzsche, in his love for people, love for the human race, love for the incredible achievements, the blossoming of Michelangelo, of the Italians, of all the incredible things that have happened, he's trying to say to you, I want you to find this energy again. It will heal so much of those pains and sufferings that you have, first of all. And then it will do something else. It will lead you to something higher. And so, like, the Greeks took the feeling of anger, turned it into Aries. And the Christians take the feeling of love and community and turn into Christ. We, and the atheists, you know, they turn Mother Ayahuasca into the same feeling. Nietzsche's asking you to spiritualize this feeling, to lift it up into the forefront of your mind and say, that's it. That's what we want to go towards. That feeling will lead us forward. We're about to enter the God is dead period where everything will oscillate between chaos. And that feeling is the way, the path. If we can follow that feeling, it will lead us out of this tough time. And it starts with the ability to believe in the feeling underneath the idea. And of course, when you pull that off, everything just opens up. Space opens up. Possibility, the exploration of the mind opens up. If you just allow yourself to be inspired, that's the first step that you can build anything on top of. And that really is the most beautiful idea you could ever imagine. I work as a psychologist now, and I talk to people. And at root, and this is a key thing to understand, at the root of the vast majority of people's problems is a feeling of shame that they are not good enough compared to a variety of different things. Other people or things in their head. But it roots on this idea of they're not good enough. And the craving inside of them is that they wish they could transform into a version of themselves that is good enough. And the belief that is core to that is just one belief. Because it's, I am not good enough and I can't change, that imprisons most people. And all you need, and it's hard, but all you need to do is awaken in them the understanding that they can change if they so wish. And that one belief is like the anchor of incredible palaces of trauma and bad memories and all this stuff. And it shakes the whole thing. And over time, it grows into a big, strong, healthy tree that bears incredible fruit. And Nietzsche saw that and said, this is the new anchor. This way of thinking is about giving that feeling its root again inside our souls and our hearts. So that humanity can believe in itself one again. So that you can believe in yourself one again. So you can believe in the incredible potential and bombastic feelings that got people to fly across the Atlantic on little rattly wooden ships. They got the Romans to ambitiously go for it and try and make something happen. They got Michelangelo and the Italians to say, let's build the Renaissance artistic revival movement. It all starts there. It all starts in this level of the spirit. Now, this, again, is definitely going to be demonized as being against love and against helping people who are in pain. And of course, this is the foundational thesis that you have to understand. I'm speaking to you as a professional psychologist at this point. I know what I'm doing here. I've seen the patterns. You dig down into someone's soul, and I'm trying to tell you the reason why they're in pain in a belief sense is so hugely founded on the shame of believing that they're not good enough and they cannot change. You see this in men where there's a massive opioid crisis. Now, what is an opioid? It's something that makes the pain go away. And so this conception of what will make the pain go away is some type of chemical, materialistic solution. But of course, it's so, so simple. I'm telling you, this is the reality. If you can awaken in them inspiration, they will develop the courage and strength to beat back their own pain. It's easy to overcome pain in theory. Now, it obviously sucks in real life, but it's within your grasp with a simple belief. I can overcome this pain. I am not broken. And if you could figure out some way of making some type of chemical that makes people feel inspired, which would probably be like cocaine or something like that, you would solve a lot of these problems in theory. But of course, you don't need some type of pill, the inspiration pill. You need simply to install in as many people's minds as possible the belief in something like this, the belief in inspiration. It's like the Greeks. The Greeks didn't have chemicals. They had stories. And the stories lifted out of people's hearts these feelings. It was a way for them to connect their feelings to something that they could see to make them acknowledge them better. And this is what this Übermensch idea is all about. This is what Nietzsche was trying to point towards. If people could only have something to attach their highest feelings to, then you could change the world. And that's not a trivial idea. Now, will it happen or not? I'm not too sure. But think about it. Do you see any flaw in the arguing here? I assure you, you don't. Because all you can do is speak in terms of limits. I love Jordan Peterson, but this was his great sin in this regard. All he could do was be like, well, you can't recreate your own values. But of course, Nietzsche, if you listen to what I'm saying here, you think inspiration is something Nietzsche invented. Do you think that's a value? That value is older than Christianity. That value is older than the West. That value is older than trees. This is the most ancient value. And as Jordan said, you should rediscover your own values. Nietzsche rediscovered the most archaic and important value and asked us and told us and preached to us that if we can lift that up into center stage, and understand that it's the blossom we're trying to seek towards. Right now, we're like a plant who had its head chopped off. And we're all freaking out, you know. We're all sitting there being like, where's the flower? What do we do? What's going on? Oh my God, I'm so scared. And Nietzsche's like this weird cell with this weird mustache shouting at all the other green cells being like, grow upwards. This is the direction that you go. And if you follow this idea, follow this belief upwards towards the sun, eventually, at some point in the future, and it probably won't be you, it'll probably be some generation or down from you, but there will be a blossom, a flower that will make everything make sense. And you just have to go for that. And it's the feeling inside of you. Find that feeling, and that will lead you out there. And until that happens, you are going to be trapped in a miasma of abstractions and limiting beliefs held together by a group of people who are decrepit and unsure of a way out, imprisoned by the belief and the fear of the big monsters that live outside your little huddle. And all they are going to do is scare you with this idea. Oh, there's a big monster out there. It's the left. It's the communists that are coming to get you. Oh, it's the big monster out there. It's Hitler 2.0. He's on his way to get you. Oh, it's the big monster out there where it's big pharma. Oh, it's the big monster out there where it's big alt-right 4chaners or something like this. The big monster out there of the conspiracy theorist. The big monster out there of the church. It's all going to be the same thing. There's going to be this demonizing, this fear, this invocation, and that you must sacrifice and you must be wary and you must cuddle together in the little huddle. And there'll never be a single word dropped about what future are we promising? What hope are we promising? What way out are we promising? The only people you are going to see furious and ambition will be the preachers of equality, who at least have a dream that they're offering to their people. The people who say that we'll create a utopia where everybody will be equal and there'll be all love. The left brain's perfect equation fulfilled. And of course, these people will be the animated ones. Everybody else will be trapped in these, being frightened by this stuff and never offered a way out. Never offered a future. Never promised. Never told that you can go into your own mind and find the animating dreams that live within you and actually try to fulfill those. Fulfill those for what they are. And they are the hopes and power of life living in you, trying to call you forward towards something beyond even yourself and your frail little ego and fears. And this is the gravity of your disgusting sin against life, your arrogance, your tepid assumption that you can just put labels and jargon on these feelings inside of you and think that you're somehow a moral person. When you're really doing nothing more than spiritually castrating yourself. And then, of course, once you've achieved that, you run around and try spiritually castrate everybody else. You are a sinner against life's project. And you should be ashamed about that above all. And you should bow in humility and ask yourself, what am I doing wrong and what do I need to know? What in me is supreme that my ego is getting in the way of? And you drop all abstractions and you see that. And that is what you can call freedom. That is when you're the hero, stuck in the huddle, no longer interested in being dominated by this fear-mongering about the great egg beast in the deep ocean. And that's when you stand mentally by yourself as an individual and say to yourself, the inspiring energy inside me, this delusional dream, this great future, this future that I validate myself, this future I believe in of accomplishing something. This is what I'm going to go for. This is real. I can make it real. This is where I lay the foundations. No one can deny this from me. It happens in me. It's real. It's the most real thing of all. My felt, lived experience, my imagination, my dream life. And that's when you overcome what is lower within you. That's when you choose to go over and upwards instead of downwards and under. And you, like an Olympian carrying the torch of life, step upwards. Continue life's journey towards something higher.